Today's show is all about love. We'll hear from a psychology professor about our brains on romance. And from 50s ballads to the pop music of today, at some point or another, songwriters in every genre have written songs about love and heartbreak. Today, we'll hear from two Illinois musicians about some of their favorite songs to listen to on Valentine's Day. Then we'll revisit a Valentine's Day story about unconditional love and snoring.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up today on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. Today's show is all about love because, in case you forgot or would like to forget, tomorrow is Valentine's Day. And we don't air on Fridays. Later this hour, we'll hear from Illinois musicians Vivian McConnell, also known as Vivi Lightbody, and Sean Newman from the band Rat Boys about their favorite love songs and possibly a heartbreak song or two. Plus, an Illinois man who's married over 1,000 couples weighs in with some of his favorite stories. But first, we're going to delve into the psychology of love. What's the difference between loving someone and just liking them, as they say in middle school? How do some people in our lives achieve that special status as our one and only, while others, you know, not so much? We're going to get into this and other questions with our guest, Frank McAndrew. He's a professor of psychology at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois. He studies human and social behavior from an evolutionary perspective. I guess that means how we got here to where we are. Professor McAndrew, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here again.
All right, so let's just start with the basics. What's the difference between loving someone and really, really liking them? And or what's the difference between a crush and love?
Great questions. And there is a tendency, right, to think about love as liking on steroids, right? If you really, really, really like somebody, then you love them. But it turns out they're really quite different animals. It's perfectly easy to like someone and just not feel that, the chemistry, even though it's really psychology. and at the same time, there are, of course, movies are made about people who are drawn to each other in a very dramatic way, and they don't seem to like each other very much. So they're very, very different. I think there's a biological component to love that you don't have with liking. You can like somebody because they're nice, they're pleasant, they share your views on things, they're generous, but there's no adrenaline. And so I think that romantic attraction we feel for other people is the pleasure center in our brain firing, and there's adrenaline in our system, and we just feel it.
But what about right? But what about a crush in love? Because a crush feels like you're whacked out in love, and then, you know, years later you take a look back and think, that was just a crush. But it feels like love.
Sure. Yeah, and we usually use the word infatuation to describe something like that. Social psychologists who study love actually make distinctions between many different types of love. And the type of love you're describing there is just pure passion. It's all physical. The other kinds of love that we can think about are the kinds that sort of grow over time. So a couple of people who've been married for a very long time, for example, their lives are completely intertwined. Maybe that fire isn't there like it once was, but they are very much deeply in love. So you need both components for the whole picture.
And is it possible to actually study what draws us to another person? I mean, is it explainable/studyable?
Well, you can certainly look at what kinds of things people respond to in singles ads, for example, to find out what kinds of features attract attention from men and women. You can certainly ask people to rate how much they value different things in a romantic partner. So yes, I, as a psychologist, I guess I would argue you can measure just about anything if you do it right.
But you have to admit, I think, that everybody's definition of love is very different. So we're trying to study something that's just so subjective. Everybody uses one word to describe so many different feelings, I think.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Yes. No, you're right. I think, again, whether you want to call these different things love versus other things or call them different types of love. So I think the distinction that psychologists usually make is between sort of companionate love and passionate love, the one that has the oomph and the adrenaline going versus the one that just has the deep caring.
Yeah, I heard someone once describe that as, what was it? Like, I think romantic love and domestic love. Was that a euphemistic way to put it?
Those would be good labels. One sounds a lot tamer than the other.
Right.
Certainly. But yeah, lots of times people think that this is a more rational process than it is. One of the standard letters that you see to advice columns comes from somebody who usually signs it something like "nice guy in Toledo," and he is complaining about what a gentleman he is, how well he treats women, and time again, they just don't seem interested, and they go for the bad boy. And he feels cheated. You know, he feels like he's done everything right, and he's not getting that love reward that he thinks he deserves. He just doesn't realize he's boring. I mean, there's no adrenaline there. And, you know, a woman can't force herself to feel that. It's either there or it isn't. As a matter of fact, there was an ancient Roman expert on love, Ovid, who wrote a manual for young men about how to win the affections of young women. And one of his bits of advice was to take them to the gladiatorial contests. Apparently, the idea was if they're sitting there watching all of this gruesome stuff, that makes their heart beat faster and their adrenaline is racing through their system. And maybe they think it's because of this guy I'm with.
I guess we can't do that anymore.
Well, there are equivalent things, though. You can take people on roller coasters and scary movies and do things that might get the heart beating a little faster.
Interesting. So I want to talk about something that is actually the opposite of love and attraction, particularly because I think that you study it, and that is creepiness. And so can you explain what makes somebody creepy?
Well, sure. Creepiness is not the same as some of the other emotions we think of. It's not the same as fear. If you're afraid of something, you know that there's a danger. You know what it is. You know what you should do to try to escape from it. If you're disgusted by something, you recognize disgust for what it is. Creepiness is this uncomfortable feeling of just not knowing whether there's something to be afraid of or not. And we can be creeped out by places. We can be creeped out by people. So to use people as an example, if you're interacting with somebody and there's something about it that's just really off, the eye contact isn't the way it should be, the person is steering the conversation in uncomfortable directions, a lot of their other nonverbal behaviors are just really odd, it could be just an awkward person. And so it would be rude for you to sort of run away screaming. But on the other hand, this is a person who obviously doesn't understand some rules of social interaction. So what other rules doesn't this person understand? So we become hypervigilant. We feel trapped in this situation, wallowing in our discomfort, trying to figure out if this person is a threat or not. And men, of course, are creepier to most people than women are because they're simply
more. I'm glad you said it, not me.
Yeah, no, it's been confirmed in several studies over and over again. Men feel the same way. When you ask somebody to describe the prototypical creepy person, both men and women immediately think of a man.
Yeah. So here's something that's always bugged me, and I want to ask you about it. Everybody seems to hold up the idea of a perfect relationship, even though All evidence is to the contrary. I mean, 50% divorce rate, nobody you know has a perfect relationship, and yet there's this, like, constant societal thing, like, if you only work hard enough, or if you only marry the right person, it'll be perfect. And it just, we all kind of want to believe in it, but nobody really does. And I'm wondering, is there, like, a biological kind of need to hold something out there as the attainable, unattainable?
Well, I do think we are optimists. And I, from an evolutionary perspective, I think this is very adaptive. Another way to think about this question is think about how often you've heard somebody say, wasn't it great when? Or won't it be great when? But you never hear anybody say, isn't this great right now?
So true.
We tend to look at the past and the future through rose-colored glasses. We remember our younger years as being, we forget all the boring stuff and the stressful stuff. We remember the good times. And if you think the future is going to be better, it keeps you striving. And so maybe you just got divorced for the third time and have had some bad experiences. And if you just give up, you are going to get outcompeted. But the optimist is the person who says, well, I didn't get it right that time. If I keep striving, it can happen. And so that person is going to pursue relationships and reproduce. And those genes are the ones that came down through the ages. The pessimist that just gave up, those genes appeared pretty quickly.
That's funny. Well, that reminds me, my sister once told me, I don't know if she's trying to get me to get married or scare me off from getting married, but she said, I never knew such depths of love, hate, and patience until I got married and had children. That I come from a very, like, down-to-earth, cynical family, just saying. So another thing we know you study is sort of equity in a relationship, in that, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, we believe that we live in an equitable society. We want 50-50 parenting and 50-50 chores and everything. But ultimately, a lot of relationship duties fall along gender lines. And I'm wondering why sort of male-dominant couples are still so common, despite our efforts to make them otherwise.
Well, that's
in a heterosexual couple.
Yeah.
Or just one person being dominant.
Well, they're dominant. I mean, yes, you can have relationships where one person just completely dominates and bosses the other person around. But more often, they're dominant in different spheres of life. One of them, you know, handles the money. The other one makes decisions about what's going to happen with the family. And so I think the equity in a relationship works not because everybody is splitting everything 50-50, but each one is in charge of sort of an equal number of things, so that they have their turn at feeling like they're the one in control, they're the one in power. But the kinds of things people disagree about in marriages, you know, how to treat the children, how to spend the money, it's a balancing act. That's why the divorce rate is so high.
Yeah.
And I think the unrealistic expectations we have play into that as well.
There's the perfect thing again.
Yeah. And also, the way we do marriage now in human history is a fairly recent thing. For most of human history, marriage was kind of a business arrangement between families. Everybody recognized that people had these passionate attractions to each other. But they also recognize that these are kind of fleeting and they come and go. And to base sort of a lifelong commitment on one of those was sort of foolish. So you had these arranged marriages and hopefully affection grows over time. But the marriage wasn't about the love. It was about other things. And so the romantic ideals that now kind of run our lives put these two things together in a way that sets us up for failure in some ways, I think.
All right. Well, we're running low on time, but I have one last question. Most of us come from kind of crazy families, because most families are crazy. And yet we all go on, many of us go on to have families of our own. That has got to be a biological imperative. That, are we just hardwired to think that we're going to do a better job?
I don't think we think about it. I mean, you fall in love, children come along, you don't sit down, I didn't at least, and rationally plot out, here are the ways in which I'm going to be a better parent than my parents, and okay, so I'm going to go ahead and have kids. I just don't think we're always a little behind the curve. We're always trying to catch up with what we've already done.
Oh, okay. So then before we go, do you have any general but sage advice for our listeners about lover relationships on this eve of Valentine's Day? Quickly.
Wow. Having my wife know that I gave that kind of advice would be very interesting. No, just we all need a little love in the dead of winter like this. So think of this as a day where you're entitled to indulge yourself.
Oh, that's so nice. That's a wonderful sentiment to end on. That is Knox College psychology professor Frank McAndrew. Frank, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're speaking to some of our favorite Illinois musicians about relationships, love, and heartbreak, and how some of our worst times make for our best music. Just to get close to you, we burn something today. And I'll run for miles just to get a taste.
First is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai, and I love Stevie Wonder. Today, with Valentine's right around the corner, our show is all about love and everything that comes with it. From the Beatles to Beyoncé, is there any songwriter anywhere that hasn't tackled the topic of love at some point or another? Before Taylor Swift broke tween girl hearts with You Belong to Me, or Al Green saved countless marriages with Let's Stay Together, Elvis was making people swoon with Love Me Tender. So, no matter if you're more into 50s ballads, country, or hip-hop, today we thought we'd ask some of our favorite Illinois-based musicians about their favorite songs to listen to on Valentine's Day. Vivian McConnell is the singer and songwriter behind the Chicago groups Grandkids and Santa, and her solo project is called VV Lightbody. Sean Newman is also with us. He plays in the Chicago bands Jupiter Styles and Rat Boys. Vivian and Sean, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having
us. Hey, thanks for having us.
Hey, our pleasure. Sean, like I said, I think love and relationships are a topic that, you know, every songwriter has tackled. And in many cases, love songs are some of the most popular for the band. Why do you think that there have been so many songs written about love? What is it that we just can't do without about them?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I've been thinking about this since you asked me to come on the show. I think we look to music so much to kind of say things that we can't express. And I think love is just such a gigantic emotion in our lives that sometimes we rely on music or movies or poetry or something like that to kind of say the things that we can't figure out how to say. And so I think that's kind of become a huge theme in music across generations, as you just listed.
Mm-hmm. And to both of you, Sean first, what would you say are the elements that make for a really good love song?
I think that might depend on the listener too, because like I like songs that are very real and say real emotions and don't kind of get too fluttery in how they're describing a situation. So I tend to like a lot of songs that are very direct, but I know a lot of other people also like songs that kind of blow things up into poetic themes and talk about them in ways that we don't usually talk to other people like directly in our normal linguistics.
Yeah, like we don't usually have like soaring violins in the background.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, yeah, it depends on, I guess the it's in the eye of the beholder.
What about you, Vivian? What do you think makes a great love song?
I was thinking about this a lot, and I think, you know, it does depend on where you're at. Are you in love? Did you just get it out of a relationship? Are you super single? Are you sad about that? I think it really depends on where you're at. But also, I mean, for me personally, it is kind of like when you can see all of the layers of love. And love to me is not always happy butterflies. There's, you know, sadness in love. There's confusion in love. So my favorite love songs kind of tend to err on the side of like maybe, yeah, like kind of real and maybe a little darker, or, you know, things. I feel like a good songwriter, you know, can capture love in a way that's really specific to them. Then the listener can find something in the song to hold and grasp onto and relate to.
Oh, people bring so much to what they're listening to in a song, especially when it comes to love. And we're going to get into that in a second. But I'm just wondering, is there something cathartic about writing a love song, or maybe by the same token, a breakup song for you guys as songwriters? Is it like you're working through it, you did it, and then it's like done?
For me, yes, 100%. I mean, I'm going to be honest, I have a hard time writing love songs when I'm happy. I write songs when I'm sad or when I'm trying to process a breakup or get something out of me. And, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily completed, because I'll always kind of like have that feeling, but it definitely helps me, process my feelings around, the sadness of a heartbreak or a relationship ending.
All right, well, go. Do you have something to say, Sean?
Oh, yeah, I was just gonna echo the same thing that Viv just said. I think it's just very like there's so many more breakup songs than love songs because you're kind of looking for a listening ear, looking to kind of confide in other people, or on the other side, you're looking to get advice from other people and stuff like that in times of need. So I definitely feel the same way where it's a lot easier to write a breakup song or a distressing love song than it is to write a happy one.
I don't know what that says about us, but that I buy it. All right, let's get to some of your favorite songs here. Sean, I wanted to start with this one, and then maybe you can tell us why you included it on your list. This is George Harrison's Got My Mind Set on You. Let's take a listen. It's gonna take time, whole lot of precious time. It's gonna take patience and time,
to do it right, child. I got my mind set on you. I got my mind set on you. I got my mind set on you. I got my mind set.
Okay, so that was George Harrison. He also actually wrote the song Something for the Beatles, which many think of as one of the best love songs of the era. He's pretty good at it. Sean, what do you like about this one?
Yeah, I just when I was thinking about it last night, I just love this one so much because it's just such a fun love song. I think when you think about love songs, I think a lot of people start to think about slow emotional songs, like something you'd dance with your partner to at a wedding or something. But I think this song really kind of speaks to the fact that love is a fun thing, and it's something that is very upbeat and poppy, just like the song is, and there's a lot of celebration and joy in it. So the lyrics aren't like super poetic or anything. Of course, they're pretty straightforward, but I think it also, like we were talking about before, it touches on the hard truth that like love takes work, and I think that it's just like important in music that like songs talk about real things, whether it's love or death or something like that. It's very direct and kind of almost blunt in a way. And I think George Harrison kind of nails it on this song.
Yeah, and let's not forget, it is super catchy.
It's got yes.
quite a hook. Vivian, is there anyone you feel just does the love song genre really well?
Wow, that's a big question. Just an artist in particular who does a good. Well, I mean the one song I was thinking about. I mean, I'm a huge Joni Mitchell fan, and one of my songs. I don't know if you're going to pull it up, but she is just for me. I really relate to her feelings around love, which is, you know, she's kind of notoriously hard. She was hard to pin down and wasn't always like ready to hop into relationships. And so I think her feelings around like falling in love really quickly and really hard, I relate to, but then also almost being frightened by that feeling where it was a little too much for her sometimes. So yeah, Joni Mitchell's a huge love inspiration for me.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking about everything that you bring into a song that you're listening to. And I just wanted, Vivian, if you could tell us about when somebody misinterpreted your song Car Alarm, when really it wasn't very complicated. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, that one, it's funny, you know, people, I want my listeners to be able to take whatever they want from my songs. I actually kind of enjoy it when people misinterpret my lyrics, because I think that just makes it, I think that I've done my job, if that makes sense. Obviously, you know, I think that you can be direct as a lyricist and a songwriter, and that's really great. But I think it's really powerful to be able to write lyrics that are vague enough where other people can sink in. I can't really think of any specific times when people, you know, misinterpreted that song. But I like that. I want people to think whatever they want of my songs.
Well, let's actually take a little listen to it. Here we go. That was great. And when it comes to love song, to both of you guys, I'm just curious, how do you think about the marriage of the music and the lyrics? Because those two have to be in love and married to work. What do you think, Sean?
I guess with that George Harrison song, the music really kind of speaks to whatever the message is in the song. I mean, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it goes completely opposite too, which makes for an interesting artistic kind of approach to songwriting and stuff too. But I think that the music can really put you into a certain mood, whether it's a slow love song, it can kind of make you reflect more. But if it's a happier love song like that George Harrison song, it can just make you kind of bask in the happiness that's going on. And that works both ways too with breakup songs as well. I mean, you can either, there's a lot of punk songs that are breakup songs that are just kind of like, yeah, whatever, like I'm going to throw that relationship in the trash and move forward. Or there's other ones that are just slow, really sad ones that are like, the whole world is ending and I'm never going to get over this. But the music in the background supporting the lyrics really kind of affects how the lyrics hit you as a listener.
Vivian?
Yeah, so I definitely agree with that, and I think there's so many approaches with song, you know, love songwriting. You know, you can add like the strings and the flutes and the violins when you really want to hit it home, but I was thinking about, you know, artists that do the opposite. The Cure comes to mind. The Cure, I think, are the best band at writing the saddest songs paired with the happiest sounding music. and I think that is also really powerful. I mean, Radiohead is another example where it's like, could be writing a super, you know, intimate song, but then it's almost sounds spooky. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is also really powerful and kind of back to what I was saying earlier about the layers of love. And you know, what is love? There's so many, you know, things behind it. I think that's also really interesting when artists kind of go in opposite direction with the music and the lyrics.
Yeah. Sean, you put another song on your list of favorites, If We Were Vampires by Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit. This one's a little more intimate. He talks about the fact that even the best love stories do have an ending eventually, which is death, and that one person in the partnership will have to be alone before the other. Okay, it's a little dark, but also romantic. Is that what drew you to the song? And then we'll listen to it.
Yeah, I think, I guess that kind of talks to what we were talking about earlier about being very real. It brings up death, which is something that all of us have to deal with at some point. But I think that the song is just such a good love song because it kind of dissects like the way that love works and what makes it work. So, I mean, a lot of the song, it focuses on the idea of time and like if time didn't exist and death didn't exist, then would love exist? And it's really interesting to kind of, I guess that's just a huge view on the world of would good and evil exist without each other, of course, too. But there's just like a really, really beautiful line in the chorus where Jason Isbell says, like, if we were vampires and death was a joke. And then he later says, I wouldn't feel the need to hold your hand. Uh-huh. And every time he says that line, I wouldn't feel the need to hold your hand, it's just like you think about like, oh, if we didn't have that like looming sadness of death, then like maybe we wouldn't have the happiness of love. And I just always thought that was a really interesting take.
Well, let's
plus he's singing the song with his wife Amanda Shire too, so it just adds another emotional punch in there.
Well, let's listen to it.
If we were vampires and death was a joke, we'd go out on the sidewalk in the snow and laugh at all the lovers. I wouldn't feel the need to hold your hand. Maybe time running out is a gift. I'll work hard till the end of my shift and give you every second I can find. And hope it isn't me who's left behind. It's knowing that this can't go.
Oh, it's really beautiful. Well, we are running out of time, so I'm going to go to you, Vivian, for our last question. Just real quickly, what songs do you have on rotation when you're going through a breakup? Not to put you on the spot or anything.
Oh, man. Actually, my favorite breakup record was recently was Julia Jacklin. She released a record called Crushing last year, and to me, that was one of the perfect breakup record, talking about the layers of love once again. And she writes in this way where it's just specific enough to her, but, you know, this thing where everybody can kind of relate to. And her lyrics are, for me, when I listen to those songs, I feel like, wow, these are such simple thoughts. How has nobody ever said it just like she does? So Julia Jacklin, Crushing, is one of my favorite breakup records.
And have you had people come up to you and say that your music has helped them through a breakup?
Yes, a lot, quite
a bit. That's great.
Yeah, so that feels really good, and hopefully I can keep doing that for people.
Well, thank you guys both so much. That's Vivian McConnell. She's the singer and songwriter behind VV Lightbody. We also spoke with Sean Newman, who plays in the Chicago bands Jupiter Styles and Rat Boys. We'll have a full list of their favorite Valentine's Day songs up on our website. You can find us at 21stshow.org. Vivian, Sean, thanks again so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us, Gwen. Take care.
Coming up after the break, when people talk about love, no one talks about snoring. Till now.
We both know that I'm not what you need, but I will always.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. This hour, we're talking about Valentine's Day, a time when romances sometimes formalize. Now, while February isn't a super popular month to tie the knot, some places do see a bit of surge around February 14th. Illinois isn't Vegas. There are laws in place that usually prevent shotgun weddings, but there are still plenty of folks who mosey on down to City Hall or the county courthouse here in Illinois to get married. Judge Bill Casely spent 32 years as a judge in McLean County, Illinois. In addition to hearing all sorts of legal cases, he's married countless couples during his tenure. He's retired now, so that means he might be able to share some of his favorite courthouse wedding stories. Welcome to the 21st, Judge Casely.
Thank you.
So how many weddings did you think you officiated during your tenure? Can you even put a number on it, do you think?
Well, yes, I can. I became a judge when I was 25 years old, and I'm no longer 25. And in the course of all of those years, I have performed 1,040 marriages, and I kept track of them. I have a little book that I keep them in, and so I know how many I've done.
Wow, that's impressive in so many ways. I love that you keep track. Is that because you're just very organized, or because you're a little bit of a sentimentalist?
Probably a little of both.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, you know, there are not many things that judges do that make people happy.
True, I have to say. You're right.
If you're being prosecuted for a criminal offense, that does not make you gleeful. Even if you inherit $10 million, it probably means that you no longer have a dearly loved parent.
Such a good point.
Lots of judges dislike performing weddings intensely.
Why?
I'm not sure, but Judge Luther Dearborn was a judge in this circuit at the same time I was, and in McLean County they have marriage court every Friday afternoon. He said, well, I'm not going to do weddings. They said, if you don't perform weddings, you're going to be on Saturday court duty from now until you start performing weddings. And so he said to me, well, you don't mind performing weddings. And I said, what kind of a quid pro quo are you offering? I did his weddings. He did my appeals from the Industrial Commission, and we were both happy.
And what do you think, when you think back on all those couples, do any stand out to you as the craziest, the happiest, the oddest?
Well, I had a woman that called me on a Monday afternoon and asked if I would perform her wedding the following Friday. And then she added, I haven't spent a weekend single since I was 16, and I can't get married before Friday because I'm getting divorced on Friday morning, and the judge is going to sign the decree, which my lawyer has prepared, and then I'm eligible to get married.
Wow. And do you know what number that marriage was for her? Just curious.
Well, he had been married 6 times previously, and I guess I gulped a little bit at that. I asked her if she'd been married before, and she said, yes, she'd been married 7 times.
Well, that's a perfect match then, right?
Well, then he said, well, Judge, you have to understand that we were married to each other once before. My 4th marriage back was her 3rd marriage.
I can see why that would stand out in your memory.
Yes, it did.
Now, in all your time at the altar, I'm wondering if, in all honesty, you developed a little bit of a spidey sense, and if sometimes couples came before you, and although you went ahead and married them, maybe to yourself you were thinking, like, nah, this is never going to work.
There were times that I had misgivings. Yes, I had 2 ISU summer school students, and this was before there was a time period, a wedding license. You could not perform a marriage on one for 3 days after it was issued. The present amount was 24 hours.
Right.
These 2 people met on the beach, and after a couple of hours of close inspection, they decided that they were just made for each other. So they came down to the courthouse, got a marriage license, and they came down to my courtroom and asked if I would marry them, and they were still in bathing suits. So I said, well, you have to have a couple of witnesses. And they said, well, we don't have any witnesses. And there were a couple of certified public accountants that were auditing the circuit clerk's books. And they volunteered. And so we all got in the courtroom. Then the bridegroom stammered, judge, could we postpone this for a couple of days? He says, we're just not sure. And I said, well, if you're not sure, you better not get married, because you're going to be married for the rest of your lives. And I had kind of given them a talking to in chambers and suggested that maybe that this was not a wise idea. And I was glad that they took it to heart. So I said, well, I'll just hold it for 30 days. If you come back, fine, we'll do it. And if you decide not to, you don't need to do anything. I'll just return it not performed to the county clerk's office.
And did they come back?
End up returning it not performed.
Uh-huh.
So I think I saved them a good deal of anguish.
Sounds like it.
But I've had all kinds of unusual things happen.
And Judge, were you ever married?
Oh, I've been happily married for 53 years.
Good to hear. Good to hear.
53 years, yes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this for us. We really, really, really appreciate it. Take care.
Have a nice Valentine's Day.
You too. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, and today we've been talking a lot about love, which, as we all know, can be expressed in a myriad of ways. I want to introduce you to two people who express their love in a very unique way. To do that, I'm dipping into my own personal archives for a story I wrote and produced for Valentine's Day, 1992. It's been a long time since I went into my parents' bedroom in the middle of the night, especially since they live 800 miles away. But for as long as I can remember, there's been something remarkable that goes on in that room, something that I've always wanted to capture on tape. So one night, when I was home for the holidays, I tiptoed into their room. I couldn't see a thing, but it didn't matter. I could hear what I'd come for. My father's snoring is only one of the many aspects of my parents' long and most of the time happy marriage that I will probably never understand. How he can be so loud and constant, and she's such a light sleeper, and somehow they remain in the same bed for decades. Up until now, I've passed things like this off as one of the great mysteries of survival inside a lifelong relationship. But after 31 years of listening and wondering, I decided that it was high time to get to the bottom of things.
Has Dad always snored?
Only when he sleeps.
How long have you been married now?
41 years.
And he's snored like this for how long?
41 years.
Did you notice this on your honeymoon, or what?
Yes. By then it was too late. There were times when I would confront him, and he either would deny that he snored or would say, what can I do?
Mr. Maxey's office, this is Marie. May I help?
Hi, Marie. It's Gwen. Is Dad there?
Sure, hold on.
Thanks.
Hello, Gwenny.
Hi, Dad. How are you?
Hi, sweetheart.
How you doing?
Okay.
I want to play something for you over the phone since I'm at work, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so just listen up.
I'm listening. But is it 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
Oh, no, much less than that.
I have time. I just wanted to know how long I should be prepared to.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah.
is it?
Yeah.
What do you mean, who is it?
You taped me?
Yeah, that's you.
No kidding. This is what Mom puts up with? No. That's funny. Poor woman.
I've tried poking him, in which case he wakes up totally indignant. I've tried putting a pillow over my head. I've tried earplugs.
Now, I understand that there is one way to stop a person from snoring, but Mom did not verify that it works. You go very close to the ear and do this. And it's supposed to stop them.
Have you ever gone to any other extremes to try and correct his loud noises that he makes?
I've considered smothering him. However, over a period of a number of years, one develops the ability to say, oh, the hell with it.
Is there an equivalent to snoring that you have to put up with from her?
No. Yeah, but constant bitching, but that's okay. I'm accustomed to it. I don't mind it. In fact, I miss it when nobody picks on me.
Why do you think she puts up with you and your snoring?
Well, I have no idea. Either I'm very rich, I'm very handsome, I'm very good in bed, or who knows? Who knows what attracts somebody to somebody else who tortures her with not being able to sleep night after night, right?
Fast forward almost 30 years. We have a postscript to that story. My dad, John Maxey, died in 2017 at the age of 91. My mom, Geraldine Maxey, is now 91. I gave her a call. Can you hear me, Mom?
I can hear you.
Excellent. Let me just make sure everything's okay. Okay. Do you miss Dad's snore? I know you miss Dad, but do you miss his snoring?
You know, there's so much about Dad that you miss. It is such a complex picture. And if I could have him back with the snoring, I'd be only too happy. I mean, I would prefer him back without the snoring. But if the snoring came with it, I'd live with it.
Wow, that's saying something.
You know, one thing you can say, Gwen, did you ever see your dad depressed?
No.
Okay, that's the other side of the snoring. I mean, you could record his snoring and playing it back for him, and he'd laugh. I mean, he wasn't embarrassed. He wasn't upset. He thought it was funny.
Somebody wants me to ask you about the story about how you met.
Oh, sure. One of the women that I had gone to university with lived very close by. And so she called and said, would you like to hear Eleanor Roosevelt tonight? And I said, are you kidding me? And she said, well, KAM is having this lecture series, and she's the speaker tonight. And I said, give me a time and place and I'll be there. And when she appeared with these two Hungarians. And one was in a cast from his, I don't know, from his neck down to his waist and had been hit by a car like 2 days before. And she had dabbled in front of him that I have a good friend I want you to meet. And he was not one to pass up an opportunity to meet a woman. So that's how I met him. And it's all thanks to Eleanor Roosevelt.
So Dad was obviously the one in the cast.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Eleanor. Otherwise, I would never be here. So,
What can I say?
I'm grateful.
You Well, at least I've done some good deed for the day.
Exactly. All right, Mom. Thanks tons.
Sure. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
That's all the time we have for today. I'm Gwen Maxey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.